More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast. This week, I talked to Orlando Bloom in a rare interview where we went deep into how to get comfortable with fear and how to change the guilt and shame thought pattern.
People say, what are you afraid of, right? I'm afraid of fear because it's like I want to confront anything in my life that feels challenging on those levels.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get ready for Smart Money Happy Hour. Pull up a chair. It's the happy hour you wish your friends were having.
Mix two money experts with some hot takes and a splash of nostalgia, and you get me, George Camel.
And me, Rachel Cruz, talking unfiltered about what's going on in the world, pop culture, and how to afford a life you love.
We're talking money, celebrity budgets, and my budget for my two French bulldogs. It's a lot.
You'll hear it all on Smart Money Happy Hour. Listen on the iHeart app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Location undisclosed. Access ready. Team Buck headquarters, the safe haven where a radio signal transmits from the middle of nowhere to the squad of patriots. This is the Freedom Hunt with Buck Sexton.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Freedom Hunt. I am here in our not so expansive Freedom Hunt quarters, but hey, hopefully the audio quality is going to be solid this week. I'm glad you all enjoyed last week with Sean Parnell and Jesse Kelly. I like to see that you were all weighing in on who came out on top of that one, the Marine or the Ranger. I have no dog in that fight. I just want to make sure they were fighting each other. That was really entertaining stuff. They're great guys, and we've already agreed to have them back in the month of August. So get ready for that. We're going to call it a spook, a Ranger, and a Jarhead walk into a bar. That's the working title. But today I got another fantastic guest for your listening enjoyment. We have our friend Raheem Kassam here with me, formerly of Breitbart, also formerly an advisor to Nigel Farage, and now just a writer, author of the book No Go Zones, which is very fantastic. I highly recommend to all of you. And he's here, actually hanging out in the hut. Raheem, good to see you.
You know, I've got a lot of formalies in my repertoire now. So, I worry about that.
Well, this is when you have options, you take the options you have. You know what I mean? You move around. That's what I always tell people.
Hard to convince young ladies that that's the case.
So that's true. But the old
this
story
like failed
when I worked in the government, and people who work in the federal bureaucracy, I feel like get away with saying this, or maybe they're the only ones who know this. But it was the 60-40 rule, and it was that basically the top 20% and the bottom 20% leave, either wash out or go on to other things, and it's the middle 60 that stay. So I think it's a good thing to bounce around and have some other things going on in your life. By the way,
are we the bottom or are we the top?
Well, we'll leave that to folks. That depends on how well the podcast goes today. But tell me, what is Raheem Kassam up to these days? Now, you're no longer officially in the world of Breitbart.com, right?
Correct. That's correct. I left there about 3 months ago. I always get antsy every sort of 3 or 4 years. When I've been somewhere that amount of time, I feel like I need to move on and do other things. And there was a whole world calling out to me, and it has been for over a year now, of people saying, what we need is this in Europe and this in the United States, and we need you to travel to Dallas and give a speech and write this book. And I just couldn't do all of it. And I looked at my life and I thought, what do I enjoy least? And what I enjoyed least was sitting at a desk editing copy. You know, and so I gave that up. I've left a great team at Breitbart London, so they're managing things, and it's probably going better without me, to be honest with you. but I'm now doing several things. One of them is our new project that I'm working on with Steve Bannon called The Movement, This is a pan-European clearinghouse to bring the right across Europe together. They're very fractured. They don't work together. They all hate one another. They sit next to each other in the European Parliament and throw things at one another. So it's effectively a clearinghouse to allow them to talk, to allow them to exchange best campaign practice, fundraising capabilities, all of that sort of thing. So we're hoping to launch that officially next month.
Well, you must be very excited about all of the ignorant but earnest trolling that you're going to receive from people about uniting the right in Europe and all of the craziness and the nationalism and everything else. But I'm assuming none of the critics will sway you from your mission of actually spreading true conservative ideology throughout Europe.
And they don't get it. You know, the critics are so hysterical about this. The Open Society Foundation, you know, Soros' group. They've gone into meltdown over this, and the op-eds.
Oh, they already have. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Because
I figured
we floated the idea through an article in the Daily Beast last month, of all places. But we like to troll the opposition media, and so we gave them the story. It comes out. Everybody loses their minds overnight. Everybody's losing their minds overnight. And last night I was on the BBC. And I did the number one radio show in the country, the Radio 4 Today program. And they put the clip up afterwards talking about the movement. I was talking about Tommy, and I was talking about the movement, Tommy Robinson. And they put a graphic on it that was a Golden Dawn rally from Greece. This is the neo-Nazi party in Greece.
This is like putting a swastika over your interview.
Oh, no, they actually, I mean, their logo is a swastika.
Okay, yeah, there
so
you
it's
go.
It's actually putting a swastika. Yeah. And if you know me, which, you know, I have no truck with anything like that. But this is the BBC, by the way, the largest single broadcaster in the entire world. And I woke up to this morning because of the time difference. And I looked at this on my notifications, and I text the producer. I mean, the tweet came down within seconds, but it was up for 4 hours. My name and a swastika. I can't believe it.
Sounds like the BBC. Sounds like the BBC to me, actually. Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of the big broadcasters, I think that people have reached a tipping point with CNN after this week. You know, for full disclosure, I always tell the audience I was there for 2 years, but mostly doing counterterrorism analysis. Mm. It wasn't until all of a sudden they started pulling me over more to do the political side of the house there that I found myself showing up. I just call it the CNN ambush. Mm. You know, I would show up and, I mean, just the most journalistically unethical, nonsensical. I'd show up and they'd say, oh, well, you're going to talk about, you know, who's going to win this Republican primary somewhere. And I'd show up and they'd say, what do you think about this, like, tweet from this guy that, you know, is saying all this racist stuff?
Yeah.
I'm like, who are we? This isn't one of the candidates. Who are we even talking about? I mean, it turned into a total, I mean, I've called it the Clown Show Network. I mean, it turned into a total cluster over there, the Cluster News Network. We could have a lot of fun with this. But, you know, Raheem, this week people, I think, saw that they really are dishonest in the fundamental conception of what they are, which is a nonpartisan news network. That is untenable now, I think, for anyone who's paying attention.
By the way, I think the idea of a nonpartisan reporter or journalist or news network is a nonsense anyway.
I totally agree. And I don't know why people cling to the fantasy. The UK, you guys started journalism for us, right? We kind of took it from you. You have papers that are honest about.
But pamphleteers, that's where it all started, right? People pamphleteering out on the streets. Go to the museum, right? Here on Capitol Hill, and you'll see the very first newspapers, in inverted commas, were partisan pamphlets.
Of course, in this country for sure, yeah.
And in ours as well. And the only difference is ours hasn't changed. We don't, you know, people don't mask their
people
their
don't talk about this
enough.
No, nobody would think it's a slander to say, no. You know, The Guardian is what, a labor,
yeah,
a labor publication,
paper,
a left-wing publication. People would say that's the way it is.
The BBC calls itself liberal and Sky calls itself center-right. Why does CNN have such a problem with owning what it clearly is? You know, I was on the phone. I was on the lovely Acela train down from New York the other day, and I was on the phone to a CNN journalist, and she was asking me about the case of Tommy Robinson. And I was telling her about the case of Tommy Robinson. And I said to her, make sure when you report this story, we're all on the record, I said, make sure when you report this story, you make it very clear that Tommy Robinson is not just appealing his sentence, he's also appealing the conviction, the contempt of court charge that he was given on the 25th of May. Sure enough, when the article comes out, Tommy is appealing the sentence, not the conviction. It's literal fake news. I told them, I was the spokesman for his campaign. And here you have a spokesman telling you exactly what we were doing legally. And she just lies about it in her copy. And of course, then yesterday there was the appeal and we won it because we were appealing the conviction.
I've also been one who's trying to...
I didn't get an apology, by the way.
Oh, of course not. No, definitely not. I'm somebody who tries to point out that when you have And I saw that like Donald Trump Jr. started retweeting this out and people made, this has caught on more. But when you have massive failures of accuracy that all are in the same direction, meaning anti-Trump, that in itself is its own form of fake news, right? Because it shows the editorial decision-making and the biases behind the scenes are giving you this result, right? After a while, it's, you know, the guy's not coming home drunk once in a while. He's coming home drunk too many times for this to just be a mistake or just to be, you know, the one issue where it went too far, the one time it went too far. And that's what I think they don't understand. They never go. They never have a story they have to retract or substantially correct, whether it's CNN, The Washington Post or any of these places that is pro-Trump in the least. It's always like a slam on Trump. Oh, we got to pull this back. Why is that?
You know, oh, honey, I slipped and fell and my lips landed on hers is plausible once. Right?
Yeah.
If you catch your husband doing that six times in a row, you're going to start disbelieving it. The problem I have with the Acosta stuff that we've seen over the last few days is this he's so shocked. He looks so shocked that he's getting abuse. You know, these are people who have been abusing the American people now for decades, calling them all sorts of names, calling their president that they elected all sorts of names, hurling abuse at the press secretary, mocking her, deriding her dress sense, going to these parties where they all roast Sarah Huckabee Sanders on the stage and with all the Hollywood liberals who are too busy with their hands up other girls' skirts to really notice what's going on in the world. And they expect us to believe their righteous indignation about these things.
Well, I think the calls for civility also, not only is it just rich coming from them, given the whole history you talked about, which I've been saying, you know, back covering Occupy Wall Street in 2011 in New York City, if you had a Fox News microphone, you were a target.
Oh, yes.
And people would get up in your face and scream at you. And that wasn't true of any other journalist. Mm. But that's been the reality there. And I would think that when you're either a Breitbart or a Fox, I was Blaze at the time. You know, you don't have the whole press corps to catch your back. You know, you don't have this notion of solidarity among your fellow journalists. In fact, they generally turn a blind eye to that. And I think they kind of secretly cheer it on, to be honest with you. I think that they have true contempt for people who are, one, honest about what they do and what they think, which is what I would say conservative media is, that much of the liberal media, not all of it. I'm more okay with Maddow than I am with Tapper and Cooper and the rest of them, because they're just laundering liberalism under a false premise of objectivity. But conservatives at least are honest about what they're doing, and they don't have any sense of support from fellow journalists about this. So I just think that it's the whole thing strikes me as a bunch of crybabies, dude. They're also just the worst. They're the worst.
You reminded me of a story about when you said, you know, you had a Fox News microphone and you.
I saw people with Fox, I was with the Blaze, and they would say, "Oh my God, you're with the Blaze." They'd freak out at me. Yeah, of course.
So I was reminded when I first went to cover one of these anti-ISIS protests in London. It was all PKK guys, right? The Kurds, and they all fly the communist flags, and I went up to one of them and I said, "Why are you flying these communist flags?" And before I knew it, I was surrounded by about 150 people in a circle at Marble Arch in London, and they were all pointing and chanting at me, "You are ISIS." And I was like, I think you got the wrong guy, you know? But this has happened for a very long time. Now CNN's experiencing it for the first time. They're experiencing what it is like to be on the opposite side, what hostility from the public can be like, the same hostility that they've been fostering towards Fox News. I mean, look, take this chap, Oliver Darcy, right? CNN.
He used to work at The Blaze.
Right.
I know him well.
You know him well.
He has turned on his former friends in a way that is sad.
But
it is sad to see.
CNN's media reporter, okay, he spends all day long actually trying to whip up a frenzy about Fox or about Breitbart. His job is not reporting. He is a paid agitator. He's trying to get the other side targeted.
It's in-house media matters. It's just having in-house media matters.
Exactly right. So why are these people surprised?
Do you think
Acosta really is surprised?
No, I don't. I think that it's all an act with him.
Yeah,
I think that he's actually
kind of.
I think that he's kind of a. He's not a skilled journalist. I think he's a pretty skilled actor, though. I think he's very good at really, you know, mugging for the camera and, you know, I'm just here and I'm just trying to do the best job and trying to speak truth to power and, you know, Sarah, why are you being so mean to me in this whole thing? I mean, it really comes right out of, you know, an acting 101 class. But you know, I know this. I mean, with CNN, you have some of the biggest names there. People always say, Buck, what about this person? I know a lot of the lesser known people at CNN. They're reporting stuff. Some of them are a little more centrist. Some of them are hardcore lefties. But they're not really the public facing part of that organization in any meaningful sense, right? They get reported, it goes on the website. Other people are making the primary editorial decisions, yes, and other people are presenting the information. And the ones who are presenting it in front of their audience, such as it is at CNN, you know, what is it? It's less than a million on average a day now, which is pretty low given where they used to be. They're just dishonest, man. And I think people have had enough of it. Like, I know I left CNN of my own volition, and that was something that made its way all the way up to the very top of that organization, just because some conservative that they had offered to keep, which they thought meant that I should be very grateful, left. And I was a marked man for them after that.
Have you ever written about this?
No, I've only talked about it on radio, but I actually probably should write about
it. I would love the book, you know, My Time Inside CNN.
Well, I mean, the other thing is I also became very friendly with some of the producers on various shows.
Well, hold on. How friendly? Is it going to be a problem?
Raheem, it's a family show. I remember maybe, you know, one or two dates.
You don't have to answer that question.
You know, I mean, like, whatever, you know, maybe, I don't know. For a drink. I mean, not
he's
a
blushing.
Date like
he's
a...
blushing, ladies and gentlemen.
So regardless of all that stuff, no, but I got to know what's going on in the place pretty well. And what you really see is, you know, there are some things that I think if people knew about, they would feel very differently about the organization. You know the movie The Departed?
Yes.
Right? You know how Jack Nicholson's, I think it's his henchman, actually, he's kind of number one right-hand man, says there are guys you can't touch. Or is it Jack Nicholson he says that? In the bar when Leonardo DiCaprio fights a guy. He's like, there are some guys you can't touch.
Yep.
That's a guy you can't touch, yep, right? That exists at CNN.
Yeah.
Meaning they'll put you on air with somebody.
Yeah.
And if you make them look foolish merely through argument, not through being too aggressive or anything else, this happened to me. You will get called into an executive office, and they'll say, you know, that's really not how we do things here, and we expect more from you. And their favorite game to play is the, we have big plans for your career here, and we really wouldn't want to see any, which, by the way, is a complete, they churn through conservatives there like 6-week-old meat. They could care less.
Now, is one of these people you can't touch, young master, is it Vanderbilt?
What do you mean, Anderson?
Yeah.
They never let me near Anderson or Jake Tapper at CNN. Those are the only two hosts whose crews would just flatly refuse to have. Every other show I end up doing there. Oh no, I mean some of the. I do a whole segment on radio called "Gurgling with Gergen," where because they have David Gergen, he goes on, he talks about Ford, Nixon, Reagan. This guy just mutters garbage all the time. But if you come on and you so much as step on, even accidentally, you know, when you're in a remote, you step on one word that Gergen is saying, you will hear from producers afterwards, like, you know, David Gergen is a national treasure, like, you need to step up. And now, for you, if you just went there, you could tell them to, you know, blank off, right? Yeah. You don't care. But when you're on contract, you're getting paid, there's automatically this, you know, the tentacles are into you a little bit, and you're like, okay, I guess I have to behave differently. And after a while, you realize you're being gaslighted, it's garbage. And the expression I use for conservatives are, there is a clay pigeon. You are there to get obliterated, and if you won't play the game, they have no use for you. They bailed on Kayleigh McEnany, now the RNC spokesperson. They thought it was useful to have her on air for a while, and then after a while they decided it wasn't.
There was the other chap as well. Forgive me for... I have terrible name recognition here, because everyone's name in this town sounds the same. You know, Senator Whiff Perlman and Buck Sexton.
Yeah, I know.
You all have those, like, those sort of very grandiose, waspy names, right? And
is this a Trump guy?
It was a recent one, and he was anyway. Look, your point is what I'm trying to add to is that the churn is quite unbelievable. Actually, you don't see this anywhere else. There's got to be something very seriously wrong inside there. And I would encourage your Twitter followers to tweet at you if they want to see you write the book about the inside CNN.
That's a fair. By the way, I signed no non-disclosure agreement. I could say whatever I could say whatever I want about
CNN. It's
in
the public interest anyway.
So,
you know, these non-disclosure agreements are rubbish anyway.
Yeah, they are.
Anybody
rubbish.
Ever gets you to sign a non-disclosure agreement, they're just trying to scare you.
Yeah,
it doesn't mean anything.
It's all intimidation. It's very, very hard to stop people from doing things unless you're really spilling trade secrets. But unless you work at Apple, I don't think that's really a concern.
There's one thing I wanted to add just very quickly, because it's so easy for us to dump on CNN, but actually what our side's not very good at is, you know, you see all these fancy graphics from Media Matters and and CNN and all these other places, they sort of, you know, the number of times this was mentioned on air or on Breitbart or on Fox or whatever it is, we don't do the same back to them, really. I mean, you know, we have Newsbusters and the MRC guys and stuff, but we don't actually pump it out like they do all day, every day. You know, we don't have, like, CNN has a Fox correspondent, effectively, Oliver Darcy, right? Fox doesn't have a CNN watcher full time.
They actively push propaganda to undermine their competitors on a daily basis. It is a part of their daily routine. It's not news cycle based. It is an offensive maneuver in an ongoing propaganda war. And now, in the era of Trump, when the tables have turned, they're crying foul because they're not winning this fight the way they used to. They're not winning it.
I thought we needed a war room, right? We need a war room like for that. And if there are any deep-pocketed individuals out there, my telephone number is. No, I'm kidding. Don't you agree that that's a problem, a competency lacking on our side in that area?
Well, I've had some talks recently with some folks on the Hill who are just not. I'm at thehill.com. I mean the actual Hill where people work in Congress and all that stuff. And we all agreed, we were out drinking one night recently, we all agreed that one of the best things, because this is one of the theories I talk about on radio, so obviously I think this is true, but they all were nodding their heads. The best things the left has going for it is that there is a sense of an institutional sense of we take care of our warriors.
Yes.
And so when you get, I mean, how many people listening to this know that the guy who runs CNN Politics, for example, was fired from Yahoo for, while covering a presidential campaign, saying over an open mic that Mitt Romney was happy to throw a party while black people drown. He didn't he didn't get pushed out of the business entirely.
Right.
He got hired to a great job that probably paid him even more after a little bit of a punishment timeout period. Yeah. Right. So when you look at some of these folks, when you look at the way that they play the game, they have all these places. And if you get, whether it's for plagiarism or some kind of now less so, but it had been the case for even like sexual misdeeds in your past, the left will always make sure that you have a place to go, you have a place to run.
Yeah, and it's falling up. They fall up.
That's when and you actually can, if you take one for the team, they will make sure that you are good to go. Whereas on the right, we abandon people on the field of battle all the time.
You know, this Fareed Zakaria stuff, the plagiarism stuff from a couple of years ago, right?
Well, he didn't plagiarize the staff that writes his articles for him.
Who was culpable for it in the end?
Yeah, right? He's putting his name on it, though. Yes. I mean, this is preposterous.
Yes.
This would be like, I didn't plagiarize. The guy I paid to hand in my homework for me did. That's basically what the defense was.
Yeah.
Which is pretty amazing when you think about it.
But, and we lose people hand over fist every day because we do the right thing and say, you know, whatever, naughty boy, you're never doing that again. You're never going anywhere again. And we stick to our word.
And you know what's amazing to me, though, when you look at the photo, and I CNN just because this week and everything is, I probably should watch more MSNBC, although I can tell you the primary vibe that I'm picking up off of MSNBC these days is that that's become this haven for former conservatives who have become really ideological turncoats at this point. People like, what's her name from the Bush administration? I think she's got a show now. Hmm. Anyway, all these, I can't remember them now, all these former Bushies. Especially some of the more, let's say, problematic foreign policy folks, they run over to MSNBC and their job now is to trash Trump constantly. And I just wonder what they think the end game is there. MSNBC is going to be done with them at some point, and this is not career building, but people are doing it anyway.
MSNBC has sort of gone back
Nicole
and
Wallace,
forth,
by the way,
it?
Is who
Nicole
was trying Wallace. To think of. Yeah, yeah. Sorry, you're saying?
But MSNBC has sort of gone back and forth, hasn't it? Because it didn't start quite neoconservative.
It was the only network, fun fact, because, you know, Ann Coulter is one of the only other Freedom Hut guests we've had on. It was the only network that ever paid Ann Coulter to be on TV. In the earliest, this was like 99 way back when. But MSNBC has experimented with the both sides of the story format here and there. Tucker had a show there. Yeah. Remember Scarborough Country before he decided that he was scorned by Trump? He was supposedly a conservative, although not really. You know, who knows?
Maybe depends. I could get a show there.
Yeah, maybe. Dude, you know, you never know these days. I mean, I think that MSNBC is a more interesting place than CNN is.
It doesn't hide what it's doing.
Yeah.
That's the thing. When it's going right, it will tell you it's going right. When it's going way, way, way left, as it does every night, it tells you it's going there.
Now, how do you feel about Trump, by the way, right now? I mean, I always tell people on radio that with each passing month, I am like further and further in the trench for Trump. Like, I just feel like he's exceeding my wildest expectations. Now, granted, I came in as a supporter, but a a cautious supporter.
Who were you during the primaries?
I mean, I was kind of, I'm embarrassed to say this now. I was stuck between Rubio and Cruz. Cruz, I can intellectually still at least justify in my head.
Yes.
Rubio was a lack of judgment on my part. Yeah. I think Rubio was, I think that I got caught up in the appearance of greater substance than was really there. That would be my after action assessment.
So, you know, I've been a Nigel Farage acolyte now for some years. And for me, it's always about authenticity. It's always I like sort of boorish characters because it means they are people, right? They're not robots who have been trained into this sort of political mindset. And you know, Nigel and I would break every day at noon for what we called a PFL, a proper effing lunch, or a proper Farage lunch is the way to.
I like this.
And we'd go till about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and then we'd get back to work for a couple of hours, and then we'd hit the pub at about 6:30. And that was a real character-driven politics, right? And so the first time I ever saw Donald Trump in the flesh was at Freedom Fest, before he was even, you know, announcing anything, and I said, "That's the guy." I felt it in my veins, and I actually have proof because I published an article the next day on Breitbart saying so, and everybody thought I was nuts. And then I bought a MAGA hat when they started pumping the MAGA hats out, and I wore one to the UK Independence Party's conference in Doncaster in the United Kingdom around a little old dog track we used to have our conferences. And Nigel, of all people, came up to me and he said, "Listen, mate, would you take that hat off? You're making us all look silly." And of course, now Nigel is one of the biggest Trump guys out there.
He's got a MAGA tattoo.
Yeah, exactly. No, he's got Trump face tattooed. That's on his back.
Like what's his name with the Nixon tattoo? We had him on
Roger Stone.
Roger Stone. Yes. We had him on the show recently. He's an interesting cat. Yeah.
But you know, I was Trump before Trump, effectively in that regard. So when you ask me how I feel about him now, look, I think there are deficiencies. I think a lot of people out there want that wall built. Want that wall?
I'm with you on this, and I feel like not enough people are saying it right now. Even big Trump supporters in the media.
Well, he's delivering so much on the trade stuff. He's delivering so much on the national security stuff, and he's delivering so much on the jobs and the economy front. And I did say before his inauguration, I said, "Look, as long as he gets jobs numbers up and the economy's growing, most people will go, yeah, we'll re-elect him." And I think that's what he's banking on.
Yeah, this week we've got this poll saying that Trump's approval, this is from Rasmussen, which people always say is a little favorable to the right, but nonetheless, it's a real poll. 50%, they're saying.
Oh, yeah.
Supporting, approve of President Trump's job performance. That's pretty darn good.
How many people in France approve of Emmanuel Macron right now?
I have no idea.
28%.
There you go.
How many people in Germany approve of Angela Merkel right now? 40%. How many people in the United Kingdom approve of Theresa May right now? Less than 40%. It fluctuates between about 38 and 40%. Donald Trump is the most favorable politician in any major Western nation right now. You don't see that on the CNN, Chiron.
No, you don't. That's actually a great headline. Where's that piece, Raheem?
I actually published that in Fox last week.
Oh, good job.
I sent you a link.
Okay, there we go. I need to start opening my email. I think, though, that this also brings up in me, I mean, I want to know how this, because you brought up these other leaders, does Trump hear... Is it affecting, because all we see in the media is these people that are like, "Oh, I hate Trump." Like, he's the way, you know, they always find people in these different countries that are just going to trash Trump. And that's not, it's CNN or the BBC is picking these people. It doesn't tell me anything. How has Trump affected politics over there? I just think that's
in Europe.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you look at what's happened since Trump, right? In the Czech Republic, in Austria, in Italy. He is without even doing anything over there necessarily. He is encouraging all of these sort of little Trumps to come up in these countries, and they're winning major, both local, regional, and national elections. And they're running on the same issues. They're running on controlled immigration. They're running on national security issues, and they're running on sovereignty-related issues, and the deep state stuff. And some of the deep state stuff in Europe is real deep state stuff. It's not like here where it's sort of in your face state. Actually, it's real under the radar. You know, the 10,000 NGOs that base themselves in Brussels, writing the legislation that goes before the European Parliament and all of that sort of thing. So he's actually encouraged real authentic characters from the worlds of business, not career politicians, to come out and say enough is enough, and they're actually getting elected all over Europe at the moment.
How has it happened that for so many people who are so, at least on paper, erudite, traveled, and I'm not just thinking of media people, you're, you know, people who work at these these more fancy international NGOs and multinational corporations. Mm. But this notion that sovereignty is inherently racist is, I think, an interesting. I think that is an underpinning. Well, certainly a lot of U.S. immigration debate is based around, well, if we have a secure border, it's just because you don't want non-white people coming in. That's you'll hear that from leftists. But I get the sense that that's also something you hear in Europe, right? That the reestablishment of sovereignty is some kind of a code word for keep out the other.
Well, it's actually a fake reaction. I had a very long phone call with a chap from Salon.com yesterday, which is a hard
look at
left.
You, yeah.
No, I only really talk to the opposition media. I think it's fascinating to study them, right? Nosce hostem, know thy enemy. Always. I only ever read opposition newspapers. I only really ever do interviews with opposition types. And I was having this conversation with this chap, and he said, what you have to understand about the left is that they have a goal, and he said he's on the left, they have a goal of centralization of power. Everything else is up for debate, discussion, because it's only a means to that end of centralization of power. 10 years ago, Bernie Sanders was all in favor of a strong sovereign nation state. He was on the record as having said so multiple times. That was what he saw as an end to centralized control, because they like command economies, right? They effectively are socialists. Now they've realized that the way to fight back against the right is to dilute, demographically, to dilute morally, and to filter everything through sort of the Hollywood liberal bubble, because that's what most people consume most of the time. They're not actually watching news most of the time. Unfortunately, most Americans are not listening to this most of the time. And so it's just a means for them. It's a fraud. The outrage is a fraud. They're only doing it for the one end goal, which is centralization of power, centralization of control.
Oh, I like that theory, actually, by the way.
I think it holds up.
Yeah, I think it does, too. Yeah. I think I always say that with Democrats, the things that I and the left in this country in general, the things that I admire, well, one of them I brought up, which I think is more of a tactical than a strategic issue, is that they take care of their own, which has a whole the left has a leave no man behind on the ideological battlefield mentality. And conservatives, it's like, oh, that guy hasn't gotten a job in 5 years because he like said that one thing that Media Matters said was racist.
Yes.
Sucks for him. I mean, that's very much a mentality. But the other thing, though, is there, and for radio listeners, they know this is a drumbeat that I hit on a regular basis. They will be in lockstep in the pursuit of the levers of power. This is a variation on the point you made, which is just that when it comes down to it, you don't see fractures in the, despite the fact that it's a political party in this, bring it back to America for a second, because America is where we are,
of course,
America. But the Democratic Party is really a coalition of disparate interests with no binding philosophical principle other than power. And so when power is at stake, you see this, because all of a sudden you have the Black Lives Matter protester standing side by side on voting and on issues with the sort of Brahmins of Silicon Valley and with the guys that are billionaires that are running all these environmentalist wacko ads and stuff. I mean, there's no real connective tissue with this other than the state, really, which is another version of saying the centralization of power, but that the big S state is the goal, and then they'll figure it out. And as long as their people have a seat at that table, they'll be happy.
I know this is trite to say, but the single most important book that any of us can ever read, I think, is Alinsky's Rules for Radicals.
Yep.
It is the playbook.
It's a great book.
But it's a great book.
Yeah.
I'm so envious that it wasn't written by our side. I'm actually kind of angry that it wasn't written by our side. I mean, you read the prologue to this. It could be a conservative text. If it were just published as the prologue, it could be a conservative text. You read that and you read the 12 rules that he lays out in that book, Saul Alinsky, you will start to see it at every level of your lives. You will see it at the cultural level. You will see it at the political level. You will see it at the local government level. Every single thing you can see Alinsky's rules in play. And I know it's trite, but we forget that there are new generations perhaps listening to this podcast right now that we didn't say this 2-3 years ago because they were 15 or 14 years old and now they're starting to listen. You've got to go and read that
stuff. And yet somehow it was a minor issue that Hillary Clinton was sending basically ideological love letters to this guy.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, was a disciple of Alinsky.
I regard myself as a disciple of Alinsky as well.
It's good to know. It's good to know the tactics. I mean, they do work, yeah. and they're brilliant. Yeah. And you see it with these different movements. And I keep telling people that whether it's, you know, I mentioned Occupy Wall Street before, and that was the first thing that I really sunk my teeth into in the media world when I left the world of the intelligence community, which is not always aptly named. But nonetheless, I left and was doing that. And then with Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter, that whole movement, that component was already inside of Occupy. There was this contingent that was very anti-police, that was the police are racist and the police are murderers. And it wasn't until they had an opportunity to grab onto something, the news cycle, that then became the primary. But you see that the tactics, the organization, the way that they present themselves in the media, whether it's Occupy, Antifa, Black Lives Matter, these are all variations on a theme. And the one thing that brings them all together is actually their adherence to Alinskyite approach.
Bingo. And almost always the same people, by the way, just with a different banner or a different flag that day.
Yeah, it's been amazing to see it play out. And by the way, you also see it now with some of the hashtag resistance stuff too. They just haven't really found hashtag resistance is a little trite, I think, even for the people that believe it. It's not quite as powerful an organizing slogan as some of the other stuff they've had.
Well, it's hard to convince most of the American public, from what I know about this country, and I've traveled it a lot. Americans are very fair-minded. It's hard to convince somebody to resist a democratic election. You know, it's hard to convince them to resist what is in their constitution, what is in their blood, effectively, what they were raised with. And that's what hashtag resistance means to most level-headed people out there, is no, we didn't like the result of that election. It's not, they don't really go after the policies, remember. They go after the election itself.
Oh, yeah.
The whole thing, the Rosenstein thing, the Mueller thing, all of this is about the election. It's not, hey, you know, and they'll throw in some things here and there, like there are some kids on the border being separated from their parents, but whatever. Most people can see through that's been happening for 10, 15 years as well. They're asking us to repeatedly call into question the decision made by honest, ordinary American people. And America, just like Britain, we just don't go in for that.
They actually think, and Raheem, this has been kind of terrifying. They actually think, and when I mean they, Washington Post, New York Times, I mean, give me your, and just the Democratic Party and a lot of Never Trumpers. But the most vicious in a lot of ways are actually Never Trumpers in the Republican Party because they feel like their seat at the table in the opposition has been taken away from them, too. Right. They feel like their whole life's work has been undermined by Trump in some way. But when you look at them and you see the way that they approach these issues, I initially thought this was all cynical, right? That this was just almost like a ratings ploy, but you know, people were going along with it as a form of almost a mass collective trolling. Now the further in this we've gotten, these people actually believe that the Russians changed the election, that the Russians convinced average everyday Americans to who weren't going to vote for Trump anyway to vote for Trump because of some Facebook memes. And I keep coming back to this. This to me is actually a mass delusion. I mean, this is frightening in a grand historical sense of people freaking out and very bad things happening because of it.
They think this about Brexit as well, by the way. They think the Russians had something to do with Brexit. You know, they can't point to anything. I mean, at last check, 99 cents was spent from a Russian company on Facebook ads. And they point to that as oh, well, that swung the election.
I try to explain to them as well, and I do a show here with a very nice liberal every morning, and so I interact with a lot of liberals on the show because she brings on her guests, I bring on my guests. By the way, we're going to have Raheem on the show soon, and I can tell when we're discussing this, you know, it reminds me of the game that they play with climate change, and they don't like that because climate change is a religious belief for them. But I say, do you believe in climate change? And that's a way of saying, you're bending the knee, and then everything that I want after that, you have to also agree to. And we all know that that's the way that it's set up, right? Do you believe in climate change means, do you believe in this massive narrative that I will shoehorn into this one yes or no question that's just preposterous, right? But that's where they set that up. I say, imagine if we did that with voter fraud, an issue that the left is also not really in touch with reality on, in the sense that they'll say there's no voter fraud. You'll hear this. I mean, I've heard Chris Hayes, memory serves, say it at MSNBC, and then people say, well, people go to prison for voter fraud. So there clearly is voter fraud. It's a question of how much. Okay, fine, but there's not much voter fraud. And I said, well, this would be like saying, was the last election tainted, or was the election of Barack Obama tainted by voter fraud? The answer is Certainly, yes. There's no way that it was not tainted by voter fraud. Right. But was it five votes or, you know, 500 votes? You know, who knows? But they play the same game with this Russia, with this Russian interference mess now. What did Russia interfere in our election? Yeah, sure. I think they did some things, but they've been doing it for decades or whatever. But you've conceded the interference. Therefore, you've conceded that this is illegitimate.
Yes.
And that's the jump that they make.
Yes.
And it's crazy.
And as I said to somebody yesterday, not that they've done it for decades. We've done it for decades as well. Everybody does it to each other. We're all doing it to everyone. You know, this is, by the way, this is globalism, right? That's globalism, is interfering in other people's elections.
We have NGOs in countries that are like, let's monitor elections.
The U.S. State Department
spent
$400,000 of American taxpayer money funding a left-wing news outlet in Hungary ahead of the last Hungarian elections.
That's amazing.
Why? To change the narrative in that country. And by the way, that's a Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, who is a Trump guy. And it was the Trump State Department that was handing this money over for this liberal newspaper.
I am somebody who remembers being asked many times in very early on in my career when I didn't know much about really the media and how all this stuff worked to go on a little channel known as RT, and which I know you're familiar with. Mm. And I knew very early on because of where I'd come from, the intelligence community and everything else. Okay, well, RT, this is a Kremlin front, right? Yeah. We all know this is a Kremlin front.
Yeah.
And this was a cable channel that's gotten hundreds of millions of online views, by the way, over the course of its life cycle, and was really making inroads. I knew General Flynn gave a speech, you know, was a paid contributor or gave a paid speech for them. People were actually showing up and doing RT. RT was a cable news, Kremlin financed propaganda channel on U.S. airwaves for a decade, and no one said boo.
Right.
And now I'm supposed to think that, oh, the Facebook ads, you know, this is crazy.
Yeah,
I mean, it just strikes me as it's so disingenuous. And we're seeing this now with them saying, oh, this election, there might be problems with this. I said, what are you going to do? Well, what people keep saying, we need to know. This is, by the way, this is one of the big lies, Raheem. I asked the director of national intelligence, former director of national intelligence, Clapper, this question. And he couldn't, because he knew that also I would know if he was lying, right? Because he knows my background, I know his background. And I also know these guys are not as smart as people think they are. They tend to be the bureaucrats that outlasted the rest.
Yes.
That's just the truth. They're not super geniuses in the intel world. The super geniuses leave and go work in, you know, go work in the private sector usually, just to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But this guy, I said to him, I said, well, what can we do? If this is all about finding the extent of this, what could we do to stop the next one? And you know what he said? There's not much.
Yeah.
But, you know, we'd like to see a strong statement from the president. This
is straight up.
They just, they're, this is make-believe.
Yeah.
It's a make-believe issue that we can stop meddling if meddling is just people writing things you don't like on Facebook. This is crazy.
And why don't we just put together a statement of principles and have all these world leaders sign it and say, we're not going to interfere in each other's elections. Yeah, great. Okay. It's not realistic, right? This is the, you know, the left likes to talk and the establishment likes to talk about the interconnected world, right? This is part of the interconnected world. And we have to, you know, as much as we give it, we're going to receive it. It's the same with cyber warfare, right? As much as we give it, we're going to receive it. And the only thing you can do is just make sure your channels are as secure and locked down as humanly possible. You're never going to, just like with voter fraud, even if there were voter ID, you're never going to get rid of 100% of voter fraud. It's just not going to happen. It's not realistic. And I know we've gone a very long time, but I did have a question for you.
Yes, sir.
What do you make of this Q stuff?
Oh, QAnon?
Yes.
I just learned about this week.
Yeah.
I've been running around thinking that Kanan was like some
rapper.
I said it was, this must be like the greatest, you know, the greatest World Cup player I've never heard of or something. I had absolutely no idea what this was. It just strikes me as totally crazy. Although I will say that they're showing up all of a sudden at some rallies. It smells funky to me.
It smells funky to me.
Yeah. I don't, people are, oh, Buck, you're so conspiratorial. This thing is happening where people are showing up and I've never heard of this before in my life. And they're all of a sudden getting nice, very, very clear photos taken of them at Trump rallies with these signs.
They just had these perfectly made signs, perfectly positioned for the cameras, perfectly right in front of President Trump, you know, and out of nowhere. I remember being asked about Q about 3 months ago. This was before Q was QAnon. It was just Q.
Wait, what is Q?
Well, that's the question. You know, what is the Matrix? but they would leave these comments on my Facebook live streams. Just, you know, Raheem, what do you think about Q? And some people would say, Raheem, are you Q? And all this sort of thing. And I was just like, I don't know what Q is. And I went away and I looked it up. And I was like, oh, it's some like fringe internet-y thing. And now to have these people holding up Q signs in the audience at rallies, and it wasn't it funny how quickly CNN and all these guys managed to have analysis and everything about
the flash
QAnon.
To bang on this
it
has been so fast.
Quick.
It's very quick.
Very strange.
I think
you'd think that we would have been like a day or two of like investigative work. No. We know all about this QAnon thing. It's a crazy internet thing. No, you don't. Either you've been given a dump. You've been given an Oppo research dump by someone. They knew that they were hiring, you know, actors or, you know, paid protesters, just like they did, by the way, when Trump visited London. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah. Not all of them, but a handful of people were hired to be there that day. And, you know, we have these casting agencies and stuff. They do it for a lot of protests. In fact, there was a story last week. They caught them doing it for the Emir of Qatar's visit as well. Anyway, the same thing happens over here. You dump, you know, 10 people in the crowd with a couple of signs. It's like the WWE, right? You get handed a sign as you walk in and say, hold this up, would you? And they hold it up, and they don't even know what they're holding up half the time. They just think it's some...
This is like the Iranians, actually. Sometimes if you talk to people who have been at the flag-burning protests, they'll film it so that it's really up close. You'll see a guy burning a flag. Yeah. There's four guys who are actually burning the flag. Yeah. So that's a thing that happens.
This QAnon thing...
Yeah, no, I'm suspicious. Raheem, you've given us so much of your time today. Can I just lightning round a few quick things before I let you go? How much of an advantage is it with the ladies to have Raheem's British accent in D.C.?
Do you know, it's actually a massive burden.
Come on.
No, I can't walk down the street on the phone without being flocked to.
There you go.
It's problematic. I have to carry a stick with me nowadays.
I'm going
to
tell you all something. There's some very, very nice young women who work in the office here. I bring Raheem in to do a podcast, and it's like I've shown up with one of the Beatles circa 1960. Like, this is really... They're like, Raheem! I'm like, wait a second. Everyone knows Raheem? The answer is yes, by the way. So, good times all around. The proper drink for a man to order... during a business meeting is what?
A glass of wine.
Glass of wine.
Yeah, a glass. I like an East Bank Bordeaux.
And the single best whiskey or scotch for your money is?
I'm actually a Blue Label fan.
Okay.
Which is, of course, a blend, but it's I love it. And a lot of people
I
think,
respect you didn't go with the single. I feel like people would start throwing out some single malt talk just to be fancy for the kids.
I am one of those people, you know, I likes what I likes, right? My favorite drink on the planet is a Whitstable Bay. It's a Kentish ale. It's inexpensive. It's not pretentious in the slightest. There are some moments, like in a business meeting, where I'll want a nice fancy glass of wine and I'll swirl it around and go, But there are some points in time, like with the Blue Labels, and actually my favorite everyday whiskey is a Black Label. A Blue Label is quite expensive, but give me a pint of Whitstable Bay any day of the week.
American conservative author who had the biggest impact on you in your formative years.
American conservative.
Yes,
author.
American conservative.
Not an author per se, but I guess an author. Barry Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative was perhaps my. And I've been to Prescott, Arizona, and stood on the steps where he stood in 1963 when he announced his bid for president. And, you know, it just sends chills up my spine. I'm a massive, massive Goldwater fan.
And finally, Raheem, it's true that you play Fortnite. What is this thing? Because I just learned about this.
Fortnite is life. it's a video game. I like to, you know, my downtime, which I very rarely get any of, but... I will jump onto my Xbox. You get dropped on an island with 100 other live players, and you harvest resources and find weapons, and the aim is to be the last man standing. But it's not serious like Call of Duty or anything. It's quite cartoony, and it's just mindless sort of, I need an escape right now, and that's what I do with my glass of Black Label.
That sounds fantastic. Everybody, this has been Raheem Kassam. Raheem, where should people go to follow and find your stuff? Where should they... follow all things Raheem?
Oh, the best place is on my Twitter account, and it's at Raheem Kassam. It's R-A-H-E-E-M-K-A-S-S-A-M.
And we'll have you come do the panel here on Hill TV sometime.
I'll be sure to wear clothes.
You can keep those. You can own the libs, but with a charming accent. Thank you.
It always works better. I get away with so much more.
Yeah, fantastic. Raheem, thanks so much. Everybody, please download and share. We will see you again next week. And remember, it's all in the reflexes.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
to the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast. This week, I talked to Orlando Bloom in a rare interview where we went deep into how to get comfortable with fear and how to change the guilt and shame thought pattern.
People say, what are you afraid of, right? I'm afraid of fear because it's like I want to confront anything in my life that feels challenging on those levels.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get ready for Smart Money Happy Hour. Pull up a chair. It's the happy hour you wish your friends were having.
Mix two money experts with some hot takes and a splash of nostalgia, and you get me, George Campbell.
And me, Rachel Cruz, talking unfiltered about what's going on in the world, pop culture, and how to afford a life you love.
We're talking money, celebrity budgets, and my budget for my two French bulldogs. It's a lot.
You'll hear it all on Smart Money Happy Hour. Listen on the iHeart app or wherever you get your podcasts.